Mr. Etkind, Reel 22. Mr. Etkind, we talked about the war crimes trial that you were actually involved in as a witness. At the time of the Nuremberg trials, after the war, what did you think of those? Did you think that was a useful exercise? Did you think it did any good?
I didn't give it much thought. I did read the papers and, you know, followed what was going on. But, you see, what I felt about it, that the Germans and Austrians, there were millions of them who were murderers, who took part in the murders. Not thousands, but millions. And here were a few dozens who were on trial. And because of it, I felt somehow the futility of it all. What is the point of punishing 1% or not even 1/1000th of the people who... So therefore, it wasn't sort of justice in a way. It was just doing something about it in a, you know, making a gesture. And because of it, I somehow didn't pay much attention to it. But I remember there was the picture post in those days, and I remember reading letters, and there was correspondence going on for a number of weeks, and the letters were, well, we are Christians, we should forgive for the crimes, and so on and so on. And that went on for a few weeks, and then there was one letter which I felt was written by a teacher who said, what right do we have to forgive? Only the dead, God and the dead, have the right to forgive. And that somehow expressed what I would have liked to say about it.
When you say millions were involved then, what did you think of the claim that a lot of German and Polish people made, that they didn't know what was happening, that they didn't know about the concentration camps? And equally, the British government claimed that they didn't realise this was happening. How much credence would you give?
None at all. I met thousands of Germans during the war. Everyone knew exactly what was going on. I met thousands of Poles later. I have yet to meet a survivor who was rescued by a Pole, and I've met hundreds and hundreds of thousands, including myself, who suffered because of anti-Semitism and who were afraid of the Polish anti-Semitism. I don't deny that they could have been, that there were some good Poles who saved somebody's life. I don't deny that, but they were outnumbered by 100 to 1, and the Germans, who didn't know, well, that again, I find it very difficult to believe, because Hitler was saying we must disappear, and I understood what he meant, and how is it that the Germans didn't?
Can we talk for a moment about reparations? Do you receive reparations, and what do you think about reparations?
Yes.
And about the Jewish people accepting them, which of course was an issue.
Yes, 20, 30 years ago. I have a friend who refused to take it. He lives in Tel Aviv. And I said I admired him very much. But why I did not make this gesture as he did, and none of my friends in here, I felt at the time that either we should have refused it as a group, as a community, otherwise as an individual it would have been meaningless. The individual would suffer because he wouldn't get the compensation, but he wouldn't make the headlines, he wouldn't make it obvious. Either it should have been a group decision, and then I would have gladly participated in that. But when I went to the meetings when the reparations were considered, The vast majority voted for it. I abstained, but then, like everyone else, I received a small pension.
And you say it was only 20, 25 years ago that you began to get this. Was it backdated? And did you get a lump sum to cover the years between?
It was backdated, and I started getting it about 21 years ago. And there was a lump sum, it was backdated sum, but the lump sum was about £2,000 at the time.
How do you receive the money?
Every month there is so many German marks. I think it's about 500 German marks which come to my bank. And once a year I have to go to the German embassy to prove I'm still alive.
Is the money inflation proof? Does it go up? Or has it stayed at the same amount for the last 20?
No, it's slightly. It doesn't depend on the inflation in this country. It has something to do with the inflation or the cost of living in Germany. Because we get it. It's something equivalent to some German widow's pensions or something. I don't know the details. But it depends on when we were examined by the doctors. It was the doctors who decided whether you were entitled to a very large pension or a small one.
Now, looking back now, do you feel that what you went through during them years has had a very drastic effect on your life or your personality?
Of course it had a drastic effect. The Second World War had a drastic effect on the whole world and on the individuals to a greater or a lesser extent. I think the shape of Europe, the suspicion that the West is feeling it has towards Russia, it's all a result of what happened during the Second World War. Everybody is affected by what happened then to a much greater extent than they imagine, than they understand.
How do your own immediate family now, your children and your wife, how do they react to what you went through?
I don't know. I don't talk to my children about it, only if they ask me, and they don't. They obviously know quite a bit about it, but not from me. I don't hide it, and I don't sort of advertise it. I started writing sort of poems and short stories, and my older daughter read some of my poems at meetings, at the Anne Frank exhibition, in the cinema when some Holocaust films were shown, and she took part in played Anne Frank, so she read some of my poems and criticized some of them, but I don't think even she read more than 5% of what I've written. But what is their attitude to it's difficult to put it into words. It was not a skeleton in my cupboard as it was in some people's homes, because some survivors decided to hide it from their children, which that was never in my mind. Neither do I want to expose them to. There are plenty of books on the Holocaust, but I suppose they glance through them, but they are not obsessed by it in any way. And I don't think there are any ill effects as a result of it.
Mr. Atkin, a little earlier in the recording, you mentioned that you've written a number of poems. Could you explain why you write the poems, and would you be willing to recite some of them for us?
Mm-hmm. About 10 years ago, I was asked to make a contribution to our twice yearly magazine. We publish sort of letters and short stories and events in one of our magazines, which is circulated to survivors, to most of our friends. And I was asked by Ben to make a contribution, to write an article. And I started thinking about it, and I didn't know exactly what to write. And then I decided to write about my younger sister. And somehow, when I started writing, it came out in a form of a poem. It came out as a kind of a letter to my sister, somehow in heaven. And it turned out, and I sent it off, was published. And from there on, I started sort of writing little poems. And at first it felt like automatic writing, which it wasn't. But it was came like a flood, and I was writing one after the other. And at the same time, that was soon afterwards, I went to Poland, and I attended a few meetings, and Martin Gilbert was giving a speech at one. And then I sent some of the poems to him, and he wrote back saying he was very impressed, would like to publish one of them in one of his publications on the Holocaust. And that's what started it off. And since then, I've written quite a lot and revised them many times. I didn't write any new ones during the past 6 months. But I've written so many and revised so many that I try to sort of answer every question that came to my mind about the Holocaust, or to ask every question, or try to. Sometimes it's my voice and sometimes it's somebody else's. I say all kinds of things that is related to the Holocaust or similar subjects, and I try to sort of to clarify the thoughts in my own mind. I've written quite a few about Adolf Hitler. One typical one is sort of he taught that murder was a way of life till it became. His aim was to create a new and different man who would spill blood without remorse, without regret. Who says he failed? It's not a very cheerful sort of poem, but it expresses my views about his teaching of the next one is called A Dying Breed. We are an aging and a dying breed, with no one to replace us when we're gone. We are the witnesses of crimes named Holocaust, still stand, silent, inarticulate, unable to communicate what we have seen and heard and felt. Words fail, murder, torture, hell, and yet, how else will our children know? Who else will our story tell? Now the next one is a short one. It's called A Gust of Wind. A gust of wind will blow the smoke away. The river's flow will wash the marks of crime. A bed of clay will hide the mangled bones, and death alone will know. The next one is, and nothing else, and nothing but, our revenge is truth and nothing else. No gouging out of eyes, no cutting throats, no justice meted out with ruthless force. The wrath of God is God's, but we accuse. Let Pilate wash his hands, get up and turn his back. Let others who are blind repeat, let us forget. We shall refuse. With hands outstretched and pointing, and fingers pointing at your face, we shall accuse. For our revenge is truth and nothing else. This, I try to sort of show that we don't want revenge in the normal way. Now the next one is I'm sort of addressing people who weren't there, who cannot really understand, and I called it "and you." And you who lived outside the Nazi yoke, beyond the shadow of the Hakenkreuz, the crooked cross that blotted out the sun, what do you know? What can you know of life, of man without his mask, without his thin veneer, without the chains that bind his hands and feet that tie his tongue? You who have never seen the dark side of the human mind. The other one is describing the death marches. April, I call it April 1945. It's a little longer than the others. It's called April 1945. Time, April 1945. Columns of men, eastbound. Place, the German Reich. The third, designed to last at least 1,000 years. Exhausted men, striped suits, striped caps, and cloak-clad feet, dragging through mud, through rain, and penetrating sleet. Strange sight, even in time of war. Keep up, you remnants of a decimated race. Keep up your strength to heal the fearer's dream. Your end will soon be over. And as it did begin, so will it disappear. The last convulsions of a dying beast can kill. So you, beware. You've come so far. Go on. You're nearly there. Pitiless soldiers marching at your side. Guns pointing at the ready. Go on. March. Head down, eyes straight, and keep your progress steady. Don't drop behind. Don't trip. Don't stagger. Do not fall. Don't weaken and do not think, no, not at all. When shouts and shots you hear, ignore them, go deaf and dumb. Stifle your mouth, your ears, go on, do not succumb, the end is near. As long as you can feel the cold, the wet, the hunger and the lice which itch, which drink your blood, you are alive, rejoice. You will survive, be strong. It can't be long. Arrival in Buchenwald. The train slowed down, then jerked and hissed just once. Its wheels ground to a sudden halt. Juden raus, jump out. Form in a line, don't talk, march, don't think, it's dark. You march into the camp, a band is playing. Searchlights above, loudspeakers blaring. Flames in a distance, you smell smoke, don't think, don't fall, don't talk, just march, that's all. Don't cry, try not to fear, abandon hope, all those who enter here. Undress, but quick. Your head is shaved, and so is your pubic hair. And then you're searched from head to foot. Oh yes, and even there. Now you're deloused by dipping in a tank and then pulled out. Your body burns in private parts. It's cold and it is dripping. And yet, inside the skin, this flesh and bone, so long as there is breath, a spark remains. Called hope, the will to live, or maybe fear of death and a desire, the need to tell. You're standing wet, your past is dead. So now this sort of the first arrival in Buchenwald. The next one is August 1942, and I was then in the ghetto. The time is August 1942. A silent Europe lies beneath the Nazi might. In Lodz, renamed and changed to Litzmannstadt, Hans Bibov asks Rumkowski for 10,000 lives. This time, half children and half old and ill. And you may choose, he says, but it's an order which must be fulfilled. Bibov will later hang, but first break down and see a priest. Rumkowski will be sent to share his fate with others in Auschwitz. But now a simple problem must be solved. I give you time, he says, 10,000 people in 10 days. True, the whole world is in turmoil and a mess, and Pearl Harbor has or will soon be attacked. Sooner or later, everybody dies. Besides, whoever heard of ghettos and of Litzmannstadt? In England, there's the naming of parts, and war will last until May 45. But now, in 42, Rumkowski has an urgent job, 10,000 people in 10 days, 10,000 who are still alive. So now, you moralizing and wise men, what would you do, have done in his place, there and then? Do solve Rumkowski's riddle if you can. I've seen how man behaves when fear strikes, when death stares at his face. Dear Albert Schweitzer, apply your reverence for life. And Bertrand Russell, lead a march, give us a rousing speech. Pope Pius, Rabbi Chief, tell us, how should a man behave? Comply, resist, or let himself be crucified and pray for his tormentors to be saved, to thrive and multiply? How should a man behave? O atom bomb, where were you then? The last line I was told by someone to omit, but in a way I feel it's appropriate at that moment, I mean in the ghetto, when we were forced, when the community was forced to give up all the children, all the sick people, and all the old, and 16,000 were taken out of 100,000 that were still left. If there was the atom bomb, I think, and it meant sort of blowing up the whole world, I don't think anyone could have blamed a person who wasn't that. That is the human dilemma. That there might be a time, a situation where man could destroy everything. But it was more than man that perished there inside the chamber filled with Cyclone B. What perished there while clawing at the wall was the idea of mankind, of progress, culture, faith. Of all mankind till then was thought to represent. There is another one, Der Führer. This which he did is lost, undone, and crumbled into dust. Those whom he killed are dead and mingled with the clay. That which he said remains. His words still ring their hateful notes, still echo and reverberate. That's another one called the same Der Führer. He taught that nature knows no pity, no remorse, has no regrets and no taboos. That conscience is a Jewish hoax, a lie to undermine the will. The victor need not justify his deeds. For weakness is the only crime. The weak must serve the strong. The undesirable make room. He taught that those who do not fight forfeit their rights. He showed that murder is a way of life. Who said his teaching has been lost? This one is, the German had a saying, "Die Juden sind unser Unglück." The Jews are our misfortune. So I'm picking up the sentence and say, we are your Unglück, yes, because our blood has drowned your hearts and choked your voice and changed it, because the echo of our cries will never cease to throb beneath the bustle of your daily lives, because your crimes can never be reversed, because our blood has stained your hands. I'm changing it. We are their Unglück, not because we were there and did all the terrible things, but because of the crimes they committed against us. This is sort of, well, a very short one. Don't give me power over men, nor let them lord it over me, for only then, if neither is the case, can I and they be really free. This is a translation of a Yiddish language song by the Partisans, which I didn't hear during the war, but it was in the Vilno area in the eastern Poland. The Partisans used to sing it in Yiddish, the ones who were fighting, and I translated it into English. It was translated by someone. I didn't like the translation, so I did it again. Don't ever say this is the last road your feet tread, though clouds of grey have turned the heavens into lead, because the hour for which we yearn is coming near, and then our marching steps will thunder, we are here. From land of palm trees to these lands of distant snows, in peace and hope we came, with our pain, with our woes. But everywhere our blood was innocently shed, and now we pledge our spirit will avenge the dead. The morning sun will rise again to dry our tears, dispel the darkness of our sad and bitter years. But if the day for which we long has been delayed, then let this song we sing our wrath and hope convey. This song in blood is writ by men condemned to die. It's not a song birds sing contently as they fly, but men who caught amidst the crushing fires of hell stood tall and fought their foe and sang it as they fell. So never say this is the last road your feet tread. The sky will clear to let the sun shine overhead, and then the pain you feel will pass and disappear, and then our marching steps will thunder, we are here. Freedom, you are the air I breathe to purify the blood that courses through my veins, and yet how oft I spill that very blood you cleanse, and do so in your name. England, the rugged coastline of your land, surrounded by the restless seas you'll miss at night, the steady drizzle overhead, your rolling fields with hedgerows interspersed, divided into varying shades of green, the clumps of trees, your brooding past, the feeble sun of your indifferent clime. You made so few demands upon my cunning and my skill, you never cared if I succeeded, failed, loved you or not. England, you took me in your stride. I've written it to contrast England and Poland and Germany. There in Poland you had to be patriotic, you had to be with us or you're against us, whereas here you are left in peace, you're left to your own devices, and somehow it has the advantages outweigh the disadvantage. Thank you.